Hello, and welcome to episode 242 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Each year on Memorial Day, Americans pause to honor those who died in service to something larger than themselves, a level of sacrifice we publicly revere. But the rest of the year, the word sacrifice tends to mean something much smaller, giving up convenience, time, or comfort, and often only when it suits us. One thing we all have in equal measure is time, and how we use that time says a lot about what we value. I've been thinking about that lately when it comes to helping other people. My instinct, frankly, is to be protective of my time. I value independence, both mine and other people's. If someone can figure something out on their own, I sometimes tend to think they should. However, my husband Travis sees things much differently. He's much more willing to jump in and help, even when it's not strictly necessary, whether it's a home project or something a family member could probably handle themselves. And I'll admit my reaction is often different. I'm more likely to think they'll figure it out, or I've got other things I'd rather be doing, and this isn't necessarily something I'm especially proud of. I think most people would look at Travis and say he's being generous, and someone like me might come across as holding back. But this also raises a question about how we think about sacrifice. A lot of what we call sacrifice today looks a lot more like calculation, giving something up now in order to get something later. And Rick, I know you've been thinking about this idea in a different way, that a true sacrifice isn't even an exchange at all, but rather a gift. So let's start today's show here. When we use the word sacrifice, are we mostly just talking about trade-offs and delayed rewards or something a little deeper?
Yeah, it's when I survey the language around sacrifice, the way the word typically is used in ordinary conversation, and when you look at news stories and when people say something about sacrifice, and they'll say in conversation something like, well, I wanted to get a bigger car, but I had to sacrifice some gas mileage. They're just talking about a trade-off. And so this is like an economic exchange or some kind of pragmatic exchange. And it's part of what we call in ethics and in economics is utilitarian calculus. It's just like it's what do you value more, and you give up one thing in exchange for another. And that's very different than the way the term was used for a long time. But it is part of what happens when a society becomes increasingly secularized. Words that formerly had a really strong religious association come to have a slightly different meaning.
And maybe you could talk about what the religious roots are of that word.
Yeah, it's very simple. It sacrifice just literally means to make something sacred. And if you look back at the Latin roots, it comes from two words, sacer, which is sacred, and then facere, which is to make. And so it literally means to make sacred. What it implied was there are certain things that we set aside for the gods. And so like in typical Greek or Roman rituals of sacrifice, they would set aside, say, wine or grain. Sometimes it would be animals, but most often it was like some food, or it could be incense, or you know, anything that's kind of precious. And you'd set aside some of it for certain occasions. And these are ways of ingratiating yourself for the gods or giving thanks to the gods for something you received.
And this was a topic you talked about last night at a public lecture I was able to attend. And one of the how you actually started off the presentation was you, I assume, did a Google search or something like that and brought up some news articles where the word sacrifice was recently used. And one of them, I think the actress is Laverne Cox, said something to the effect of that, you know, all the sacrifice and long hours that I had to do coming up in this profession is now finally paying off because I've become successful. And, you know, also there are times where people give up spending, going on that vacation or spending a bunch of money on something they want because they know that, you know, putting more money in their 401k or investing it wisely, you know, are there have benefits in the future. And I know that's maybe not the sacrifice that you're thinking of way back when, but at the same time, one thing that's changed in our society a great deal over the past generations is we're much more of an instant gratification society, that we can go online and order a pizza and it'll be delivered to our house within a half hour. We can watch any movie we want from sitting in our on our couch on our TV. And I think for a lot of people saying, no, in fact, I'm not going to do that, that the smart thing to do is to not spend that money or whatever the want is at that moment. I mean, that's something that I think is tougher or can be tough for people today, because that is certainly going against a lot of what society sort of pushes you to do.
Yeah. And so this is, I think, very revealing. So what Laverne Cox says, and like what a lot of us says, is like, I had to make certain sacrifices in order to get where I am today. Or they might say, I'm making these sacrifices. That is, I'm not spending money on things I'd like to do. I'm not taking vacations or worth because I want to achieve something else in the future. So it's putting something aside, either time or money or certain desires, the fulfillment of certain desires and things. You're putting them aside for your future self. And that's very different than putting something aside for the gods. I mean, what we've lost is, like, we, most of us, don't live in a world in which the divine is like really present and all around us, where it makes sense to talk in that way. There are some people that still talk about sacrifices in the original religious terms, but for most of us, we've replaced ourselves and other things we'd like to do with the gods. And so then the language of sacrifice just becomes part of the market exchange. This is what I mean. Like, it's revealing in that it shows us how deeply we've lost something. Now, whether we regret that loss or not, that's another thing entirely. But it certainly reveals a kind of loss in our society.
At this public lecture last night, you and your colleague Tom Thibodeau talked for about a half hour, and then we broke into small group discussions just so we would sort of speak about those things. And I was at a table, and one of the people at the table is actually a podcast listener. Hello, Bob. And we were talking about this, and it wasn't Bob, it was somebody else that said that one of the discussion points was how did someone, I think, sacrifice for you, I think was sort of how it was framed up. Maybe, I guess, who in your life has made sacrifices for your benefit was the actual question. And someone at the table told a story about how they grew up in a very low-income family, and their parents, you know, worked multiple jobs to help put their kids through school. And I mean, I didn't quiz them, but it sounded like all of these, as these children became adults, they became successful and got to go to college, and I think made their parents proud. That's not like giving up a dinner out to send your kids to college. That's a lot longer term thing, especially if you have multiple kids looking to do all this. So that's like a deeper level of sacrifice than some things. But is that closer to maybe what you're talking about? Because it is, you know, affecting people who, you know, one of the things parents often say is they want to make the lives of their children better than the lives they had themselves.
Yes, and I think this comes closer to what we find in the New Testament, where the Apostle Paul says something: make of yourselves a living sacrifice. Give yourself out of love to God and your neighbor. That's what he's talking about. And I think any time where we give something of ourself, and this can be our time, our resources, our attention, whatever it is, but we set some part of our lives aside for the sake of others, and we do it out of love. That makes sense. That's a sacrifice that is pretty close to that original term. But What I like about that and why I think it stays true to the language of sacrifice is it is taking something of our lives outside of the marketplace exchange, right? It's not a trade-off. If I'm investing myself in my children's future, it is for their sake. It's not because I'm expecting to get something back from it. It's a benefit for them. And I think that fits, for my understanding, the meaning of sacrifice.
I was talking with some journalists a couple of weeks ago, and there was a story this particular newsroom was working on, and I hope I remember the details right, but I think I do, that there was some sort of K-12 school, high school, grade school, I don't remember, and one of the teachers had an illness that required a kidney transplant, and they did there's some testing you can do to see who's a good match. And my memory of how this turned out was that somebody at that school, another teacher, I think, was a match, and he or she agreed to donate a kidney. And this person, you know, we'll hope will do well. I mean, kidney transplants are can be very, very successful. And like, no doubt that's a sacrifice, right? I mean, we don't question that. But then one of the reporters, again, this was just a internal conversation in the newsroom, said, you know, I think it was his nephew or someone signed up, and you can do this, where you can sign up and give a, you know, say, you know, I think take a test and say, here's my blood type and all sorts of other markers, and say, if there's somebody somewhere in the country who matches me, I'll donate my kidney, even though I have no idea who this person is.
Yeah, and this is... most states have a donor registry, right?
Yeah.
So you sign up as a living donor.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. And like, so it got me thinking that I don't want to for a second minimize the level of sacrifice that this teacher made for his or her colleague, but presumably this was someone they knew and cared about and had some sort of relationship with. To me, that sort of even the step further is doing this for someone you may never meet. If I guess I'm starting to go down the path of sort of scoring sacrifices here, but I think doing something for a stranger, not someone who's in your family, not a colleague at work, but someone you'll never know, I mean, that even feels closer to what like a selfless sacrifice is.
I think whenever you give something up out of love, whether it's somebody that you know, it could be a friend or family member, or it's a stranger, It's a sacrifice. You're setting aside part of your life. What we find is it's somehow even more admirable because it's more rare when somebody does it for a stranger, because there isn't this emotional tie already. Mm-hmm. It's harder to see how you'll get anything back, because there is a kind of reciprocity in friendship and relationships among family members, right? But there often isn't with strangers. And so we think of that as being heroic or noble. I mean, and this is what we celebrate about soldiers who've given their lives or been injured. When we do this on Memorial Day or any time of the year, we think of this in heroic terms. Like this is a sacrifice beyond what most of us are called to do or expected to do, but they do it anyway.
And I'm going to take something now very serious, like we just talked about, donating an organ to a stranger, which is a major sacrifice, as we talked about. And I'm going to now pivot to something I kind of started off talking about at the start of the show, is sort of maybe these more everyday, I've used the word sacrifice, and you can tell me if I'm using the word wrong. But like I said, I sort of set this show up today that Travis and I are pretty different this way. And I'll give an example as to what I mean by that. So his father runs a small business, and he's kind of a one-man shop. But like a lot of small businesses, you have billing and all those things. And like every 10 years, he replaces his computer because at some point computers just sort of run out of steam. So he had done that recently, you know, hooked it up and it meets all his needs and terrific. But he had this old machine, and he's just, you know, he's obviously smart enough to know you don't just throw it in the dumpster because bad things there. I mean, not only from the environment, but like people's like information. Mm-hmm. So he's like, so what do I, and he's like, well, I wasn't sure what to do and all this. And then Travis's response was, you know, don't worry about it. Just, we'll take care of it. We'll bring it back to our town. There are occasional places where you can, like, you know, e-recycling events, and we'll just find one in our city and take care of it for you. And it's fine, of course. I mean, so it's like there's a pile of things sitting at the corner of our garage waiting for this thing. Now, this is obviously not the biggest sacrifice mankind has ever made, but part of me couldn't help it. I hope, you know, I guess if you're listening, hello, Randy. But part of me is like, you know, he lives in a town that may have these things. I mean, could it, you know, at some point, are you like taking away other people's like independence? Like, you know, they could figure this out, and he could find a way to do this. And what made me think of all this, and this will spin back to the public lecture last night, as I was thinking about this topic the other day, I often try to think of like, what's the opposite of sacrifice? And in this situation with, you know, the recycling of the computer, I thought, well, you know, I'm sort of taking away someone's independence, or forcing them to be more independent about something that they obviously clearly have the capacity to do. And I asked your colleague at the event last night what he would say the opposite of sacrifice is. And without even thinking about it, he said selfishness.
Right.
And so it made me think, you know, probably I was being selfish a little bit in like this, you know, small example of like the recycling.
Well, I think you are in that case, because you can easily then justify not ever helping anybody else because you're taking away their independence.
Mm-hmm.
And like
or giving them a learning, or
give them a learning, yeah, opportunity, whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
I mean, this is a remarkable talent that we have as human beings, is able to rationalize just about any behavior, mm-hmm, and make it seem virtuous to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why most people think, if you ask them, you know, like, are you a good person? Oh, yeah. And they'll give all kinds of reasons, but behavior differs widely. But in that case, I think, yeah, you are being selfish, because like what Travis did is, yeah, he's just helping somebody else who could use a hand. And we're often in that situation where there are things we could do ourselves, but it's outside of the area where we feel comfortable, where we have much knowledge, and it's quite easy for somebody else to do it. Now, what you don't want is a relationship to develop where you're never paying it back to anybody else. Right. And sometimes you get to know that, especially people you know really well, like a good friend or a family member who really has become dependent on others and not like, then I think what you're saying makes sense, where you, mm-hmm, might just say like to your brother or sister, like, look, like, you're always asking me to do things for you, but you're not doing anything in return. Like, I'm not going to do this for you this time. Like, that makes more sense. But you're talking about, you don't know anything about this person, whether they need a lesson in independence. And so why not just help them out?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably right. And again, this is, you know, pretty low stake stuff. It'll sit, you know, this small stack of hardware will sit in the corner of our garage for a month.
But the low stake stuff is important, because it exists on a continuum. Our small acts of generosity accustom us to setting aside part of our lives that's not for our own personal gain, our personal benefit, but for the sake of the well-being of others. When we practice doing these small things, it prepares us for those occasional times when we are asked to sacrifice something much greater. And this is why with children, it's very important to develop small practices of generosity. This is why it's very common for children to get allowance, but then also for children to learn that, like, giving up a portion of their allowance to have opportunities to give, that's an important lesson too for children to develop at an early age.
I also think we can agree that we live in a society today where, in many cases, and again, setting aside sort of physical limitations we may have that prevent us from doing things, that we live in a society where we can be a whole lot more independent than several generations ago. And I think this came up in the lecture, I think maybe Tom brought this up last night, is that our lives in many cases, not all cases, are pretty comfortable. I mean, our lives are a lot easier than, you know, our grandparents or great-grandparents were. And I think that that does allow us to probably rely on other people less often than maybe was required you know, many years before. And I think the danger around that is that, and we've talked about this so many times on this show, that if the more things that we don't need other people to help us with, the more insular we become, and that we don't build those relationships that just make us better people. Of course, I say all this with the caution in the back of my mind, and that you said at the beginning of this, is that sacrifice should not be a transactional thing. You know, thinking back to, you know, this country's agrarian past, where you might have the farmer in the next acreage over come help you plant your corn, and then a week later you'll go over and help him plant his wheat. I mean, that's like probably helpful, but that's
well,
not.
For example, during the 1930s, when you'd have these threshing parties, and you would have the threshers come too, and you would have all the neighbors coming to help out on a certain farm, and then everybody would go to the next farm and the next farm.
Yeah,
and this was part of a, in some ways, kind of a ritualized exchange, right, of labor.
And that built, and that served two purposes, right? It helped with harvest, but it also helped build stronger communities.
Absolutely. And when you hear stories about this, they'd have big picnics because they'd feed everybody. And so you'd have the men out doing the threshing and the women fixing all this food. And the whole thing was very hard work, but then these neighborhood gatherings or parties. This interdependence builds much stronger community ties.
And we do talk about so much of our lives as children and teens and even young adults is stressing the importance of being independent, right? Is that if you want a cell phone or you want a car, you have to save up enough money to buy it or pay for the insurance or the gas or whatever it might be, right? And then you move out of the house and you're independent and you have your own place and you have to pay rent or a mortgage or whatever it might be. And like we have this whole matriculation as we age to become independent. And I think for some people that does make asking for help from others, for sacrifice for others, become maybe more difficult because they just feel like their whole journey into adulthood has made them, the goal was being independent.
Right. And what we see is over time, people are becoming less interdependent.
Yes.
Right? Because we can do more things on our own. So overall, we're wealthier. As a society, that doesn't mean that everybody in the society is wealthier, but like there's more wealth being expended, being gained and created and expended. We have greater technology that allows us to do things without getting other people's assistance. So we're becoming more independent. The problem is we're also becoming more individualistic. And as we track like personality profiles, every generation is more individualistic than the previous one. And this is our great challenge. How do we live in a world in which the growth of technology and new developments allow us to be less dependent on other people, more independent, which is a good thing. We can do more, but not become more individualistic at the same time, still have a sense of community and a connection to others. And what we find is, like, this is something that young people increasingly are saying, is that they don't have a sense of belonging and they really desire belonging. Well, when you become more individualistic, that's pretty much what it means, is that your identity isn't tied up in a community anymore. It's tied up more in yourself. And this is experienced as a loss. So this is something we can do intentionally, but you do it through these acts of generosity and sacrifice.
Do you watch the HBO show The Pit?
No, it's on my list.
Yeah.
It's one of those shows that I've been wanting to watch for a while.
Season 2 is just wrapping up now, and I highly recommend you and others watch if you haven't. And I promise the story I'm going to tell is not a spoiler for the show if you haven't seen it. But what the show does well is there are story arcs, some that I should back up for those who are unfamiliar. The Pit is set in a Pittsburgh emergency room that sees all sorts of, like any emergency room, sees all sorts of things that happen, and people walking in with some small problems, some people walking in with some catastrophic problems. And although from talking to people who have worked in real life ERs, they say that all of the things that happen on that show may not happen all in one day. It really does a good job of showing all the things the people in those places face. And one of the really small storylines that came up this current season is a couple who I think a couple maybe in their 80s, if my recollection's correct, is that the wife was on, or maybe the husband, doesn't matter, was on some medication, and he had a slip and fall in the house and was banged up a little bit, but they determined that, you know, he was going to be fine. But the bigger discussion once the daughter arrived was, you know, this couple still lives in their home, and it's probably, you know, like it was two stories, and it's probably not designed for people whose health is declining in their 80s. And it was just sort of this discussion that this daughter was having with her parents about how they can continue to live independently. And it just, and that's a discussion families have across this nation, right? And it does, and I guess it kind of goes back to my independence topic I brought up a second ago, but there is a time, I think, that many of us reach in our lives where sort of giving up that independence is sort of a proper sacrifice in a way, and realizing that we can't do what we could have done in our 50s, 60s, and even 70s, and that the people who you cared for your entire lives, your children, are now going to take a little more, the roles are going to be reversed a little bit. And because that can happen maybe sometimes suddenly and sort of and maybe even though we all know it can happen, can also happen sometimes unexpectedly, I think those conversations can be difficult. And it does, and I think it does relate to this topic of today of sacrifice, because you're asking this, you know, couple who I think on the show had been married, you know, 50, 60 years and lived in the same house for most of that time, to really sort of sacrifice things that they've really kind of some cases the only things they've known.
Yeah. And this, when we see people who have aged really well, we talk about people who age gracefully, right? One of the things that they have in common is they start preparing in their 40s and 50s for that last third of their life, like the retirement years. They start thinking about, okay, they've been in a stage of accumulation, and then you get a certain point of your career where it's your peak of your career, and then you start looking for, when are you going to have more opportunities to give back? And so you create in yourself a sense of, well, a good part of my life is focused on what I can give to others. But you create these habits of mutual interdependence. And that's reciprocal, so that there's a point in your life where then you're going to be dependent on others. And you don't resist it. You feel good about it because you haven't held so tightly on to independence, because you've been generous with your life for others. This kind of mutual interdependency, this relational component of life, feels much more natural and welcome to you. And so we find this among people that age very gracefully, is that, like, yeah, they've both been generous with their life, and then they look forward to a time in life where they get to accept the generosity of others.
Before we close, I wanted to touch on one thing that came up at last night's lecture and in the discussions we had at our table and some of the discussions that were happening at other tables in that room. And that seemed to be the sense that the people who sacrifice time or sacrifice anything for others and are doing it for all the right reasons never seem to want to take a lot of credit for that, or certainly don't feel like bragging about it. They're not going to say, oh, remember that time your car broke down on the road and I drove 3 hours each way to help you in the middle of a thunderstorm. And remember, I mean, that's and consistently brings that up time after time. That's like not what I think most people think of as someone who's doing things for the right reason does. I agree with that, but in the back of my mind, I kept thinking to myself, but do we sometimes, though, need to be reminded that other people sacrificing themselves for, you know, time, money, whatever the sacrifice may be, if we're not doing it enough, how can we remind others that it's still important without turning into the guy who just brags about all the good things he does?
I will sometimes encourage people that have done good things in terms of either donations or spending time with others to like not to be too shy about letting other people know, because one of the things they're doing is they're setting a very good example.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And it doesn't mean that in making it known that you're giving to others in this way, that you are bragging about it or trying to impress others. You're just helping to establish that this is a norm. This is how people act. And when you exhibit publicly really good behavior, it inspires others to do the same thing. But this is hard for many people who don't do things for self-aggrandizement. They're just doing it for the benefit of others to even want to take credit or be acknowledged. And but the important thing to say when somebody praises you for being good is just to say thank you. Don't try to deny it. And you'll see this often among very generous and well-meaning people is you praise them for something and they say, oh, it wasn't anything, or like they'll kind of deny that they behaved well. No, just say thank you. Like it's important to, I think it's important to be visible in our most generous activities.
Although you said the proper response is to say thank you.
Yeah.
I've also heard people say, I'm happy to help, and I hope you do something else for someone in need someday, sometime. And that's an okay message to send, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's part of just making it visible, making sacrifice a social norm. So, Scott, we end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And what have you got for me today?
So recently, Rick, I was riding in a car with a friend, and he had the radio on, and a Michael Jackson song came on. He immediately changed the station. He told me that given everything that's come out over the years, he no longer feels comfortable listening to Michael Jackson's music. That got me thinking. Are there certain artists whose work becomes off limits for you because of their behavior? And is it possible or even appropriate to separate what someone creates from who they are?
It can be hard sometimes because many of the performers, the singers, songwriters that we really admire, even authors, we admire their works. We want to admire them along with it. I think it's both natural and good to separate their works from their personality, because it's just an acknowledgement that people are really complex. And if you look back in history, you have lots of examples of really flawed people creating magnificent works of poetry, of paintings, music, what have you. And so then to bring this purity test is I think a bad idea. Now, if it just I can't help but think of this person's awful behavior whenever I hear this song, so I don't want to listen to it, that's one thing. Like it makes it not enjoyable for me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. But if it's like a principled stand, like, no, I'm not. I disagree with certain things he did or the way this person lived their life, so I'm not going to listen to their music or look at their art or watch their performances on television anymore. I think Like, that to me doesn't make any sense. Separate their work from their person.
But I mean, it does to me, though. It feels like it matters what that person did. I mean, I'll just pick a person at random. Kid Rock, who is pretty public in his support for President Trump. I think appears at some of his rallies, and, you know, obviously he should do what he thinks best. But if you're like a guy who doesn't like President Trump, you may not think much of Kid Rock and his music. But to me, that's very different than like Michael Jackson, who, and again, I'm not going to go into all the details because he was never, you know, didn't live long enough to be convicted of some pretty awful things. But like, all the reporting shows that he was, you know, sexually assaulting children. And like, that to me is like several orders of magnitude worse than like publicly supporting a political candidate who with whom you disagree. It does certainly matter what like the allegations against this person are, right?
And I think like we have pretty good evidence that Phil Spector was a really awful person and treated mostly artists that he had under contract really terribly, and so they were exploited, and yet like created just amazing music. Now yeah. That goes back a ways, but it's also a lot of music, and you start bringing these criteria together, and pretty soon you're listening to like just a small amount.
Well, and just a couple days ago, I was watching a movie, and at the start of every movie brings up the studios that funded the film. And it was a movie from the 90s, and front and center at the beginning is Miramax. Well, I mean, I know enough that that's like a Harvey Weinstein-led enterprise, and we all know he's just a bad guy. So, like, should I have, like, oh, I didn't, and I didn't realize that this was a Miramax film, and should I have just been like, well, I'm not watching this, and turned it off, or should that matter? In this case, for me, it didn't matter. But I think part of that is because even though you see that at the beginning of the film, that quickly gets scrubbed from your mind. But if, like, not that Harvey Weinstein was acting in films, thank goodness, but, like, if he were in every scene, that would be a constant reminder that, like, this film is, like, featuring this bad guy who ended up being a bad guy.
And I think it's very different, for example, if Michael Jackson were still alive and he was coming to our city and giving a concert, are you going to buy tickets to the concert?
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't want to support his career, you know, like because of what he's done, that sort of thing. That's very different from saying, oh, he's been dead for quite a while now. If I listen to the song on the radio, I'm not supporting him. He's not profiting off of this. His estate isn't profiting. So I'm just listening to the music and appreciating the music for what it is. And I'll say we can think about it in the other way, too. Of a quote came to mind. This is from Hermann Hesse's novel, Journey to the East, that was really responsible in many ways from inspiring Robert Greenleaf to come up with the idea of servant leadership. It features a character named Leo who is a servant all the way along as these different characters are on this long journey. Here's Leo taking care of their bags and serving meals and doing all these things. And then you learn out later when they get to their destination, like he is the king, like he's the ruler or the leader. And so the leader has been the servant all the way along. But the novel closes in a very interesting way in which Leo and one of these characters is engaged in a conversation. And one of them says, the creations of poetry become more vivid and real than the poets themselves. That is, that this naturally happens, that even that it any kind of work, if it achieves some kind of stature, some kind of greatness, the work itself becomes more prominent, and the person who creates it might even be forgotten. And I think that's true. I mean, and it's not a moral judgment on, like, how much should we think about the creator of things? It's just a fact that certain works of art become so great, they kind of stand on their own. And you even talk to artists who create really great poetry or works of fiction or paintings, whatever, and they talk about inspiration. Like, they don't know where it comes from. It just appears. It's like a gift to them as well. I don't think there's any reason we shouldn't just appreciate it on its own merits.
I want to just, for us, before we close, just bring this a little bit different direction. Although you and I are both familiar with Michael Jackson, we never knew Michael Jackson. And both of us may be familiar with all the bad stuff Harvey Weinstein did, but we've never met Harvey Weinstein. But we have known people in our lives who have done bad things. And, you know, maybe it was something they did last month or something they did 25 years ago. And it does sort of get to the point of how you forgive that person. And I don't even know all the details, so I'll really fuzzy this up on purpose. But there was someone who I was acquainted with in high school who, a few years after high school, I learned robbed a liquor store had a gun, and I think served some time in prison. And I know he was probably early 20s at that time. And so this has been 30 years ago. This was somebody I was not close to. I will assume he's still with us somewhere and stopped robbing liquor stores. But like, if I somehow was reacquainted with this person, I mean, I think most people would say you should not judge this person on a mistake he made 30 years ago. And that's like the right way to approach that situation. And again, unless, you know, if he got out of prison and continued doing awful things, well, I guess maybe that's different. But like, we do seem to have the propensity to forgive people we know maybe more than the people who we don't know personally. Does that seem right to you?
I don't think you can forgive somebody that you don't have a relationship with, because to forgive somebody means to reestablish the relationship. But you can let go of the anger towards them or the desire for retribution, that sort of thing. You can let go of those things. That's at least part of what we mean by forgiveness. And you can do that with strangers. So I think of this old person I went to high school with, and I don't think he should be held accountable anymore for those past mistakes. You know, like you can make that judgment. Yeah. And I think that's appropriate lots of times, and because, you know, especially if they paid their dues, what society thinks, and like they should be held accountable to. But yeah, there's a certain point at which, like, what's the point of holding on to anger towards them? Even to somebody like Michael Jackson, who did, by our report, some really terrible things. There's also, I mean, you have to have some kind of understanding that here was a deeply flawed person who was raised in really unusual circumstances. And we have really no understanding of what he was going through. Now, that's not an attempt to forgive him. Just an attempt to say, like, yeah, this is what happens to people. And when kind of terrible things happen to people, they tend to do terrible things to others. Things that were done to us tend to get passed down, and sometimes passed down and magnified towards others. Well, that's just what happens. And our best attempts in our life is to try to do what we can to interrupt that cycle.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and it will touch on many of the topics we spoke about on Sacrifice at the start of today's show. And that column can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rotta. Thank you for listening.